Welcome to the Reboot Republic podcast, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast about solutions. We are the podcast of hope. I'm your host, Rory Hearn, and joined today again by my alter ego and great buddy, Tony Groves. Tony, how are you?
I'm good, Rory. I'm good. I'm actually looking forward to this conversation for all the wrong reasons, because it's something that's kind of slipped under the radar, given the way our politics has gone in the last few weeks. But go on anyway.
Yeah, we're joined today by Anne-Marie O'Reilly, who's a policy officer with Threshold, and Gavin Elliott, who's the legal officer with Threshold, the housing charity and rights information organization. And I suppose what Tony, you're saying there, we've seen, you know, major changes implemented in response to COVID by the government implementing a ban on evictions and also a rent freeze. And of course, that was changed last week with this new legislation that's introduced with very significant impacts on tenants. And I suppose the big issue is that we've never had as many people renting in the private rental sector as we do have now in this country. And so this legislation has major impacts for hundreds of thousands of people who are living in this situation. So maybe, Anne-Marie, thanks a million for joining us. And Gavin, thanks a million as well for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Wrong at all.
Anne-Marie, maybe you could start by outlining, like, what is the situation facing tenants at the moment and kind of in this kind of world?
Yeah, so I suppose when all this happened back in March a million years ago, the first impact was really on, I suppose, from what we saw was on the licensees and students and house shares. And very, very quickly, licensees, so that's often people who rent a room in an owner-occupied house, or perhaps there's a head tenant in their house and they rent a room from them, they suddenly found themselves being told, right, you have to leave, you're out today, we need to social distance, we need to mind ourselves. Now, sometimes the homeowner was older and vulnerable and quite concerned for their own health. Others were, the person they were renting from was placing them under huge restrictions where they could go, when they could go, what, you know, and things like that. And then when the colleges closed down, the students, many of them left their house shares, and they want to know what notice had to give, could have deposits back. And as well for workers, young workers who lost their jobs, those who could return home did so. And that then left those who were still renting the home with the entire rent to pay on a house, which they couldn't afford. those are the first people we saw hit back in March. And then it more generally across the board, everybody and anybody who was renting, I suppose the ESRI have done a good bit of work in showing that the people hit, the sectors hit the hardest with the job losses are of people who predominantly rent. And I suppose it's not something I guess any of us would have anticipated, that renters were going to be hit in this way. So then, of course, we were anticipating the rent arrears. So while rent supplement was made readily available and the process for applying for simplified, renters don't know. So there's been, what, about 700,000 people applied for the pandemic unemployment payment, but only about an additional 5,000 to 6,000 people applied for rent supplement since March. So there really is something missing there. There's a gap there. And then what we saw in the last few months is a doubling of the rent arrears queries that came to us compared to the same time period last year. So we went from about a little over 200 queries on rent arrears to over 400 queries on rent arrears in the first 6 months of the year. And the majority of those queries are from people who were in arrears for 1 to 3 months. So these aren't arrears that carry over from earlier or which have been accruing for quite some time. These are arrears that accrued as a result of the job loss or income loss. And, you know, we ask people, how did this happen? And it's, I lost my job, I lost my income. There's an occasional case, and I suppose this is one we also anticipated, where perhaps somebody is receiving, maintenance. Yeah, so maybe where a parent was receiving maintenance and that was going toward the rent, but then that other parent lost their job and that maintenance payment stopped. You know, so I suppose there was a couple of households as well that found themselves in that situation. And then shockingly, and I suppose despite the fact that I worked in housing and homeless services for years, I was still shocked to see the level of evictions that occurred despite the moratorium on evictions. And so again, in that same time period, there was a higher number of illegal eviction cases brought to us compared to last year. Some evictions carried out, people came home, locks changed, good luck and goodbye to you. Mm. Some of those people did end up in homeless services. Some we were able to get reinstated in the home, but they don't feel safe in that home now, and they are desperately looking for somewhere else to move to. So that's sort of the lay of the land for a proportion of renters out there. And of course, there's all the others that we haven't heard from, and who perhaps aren't aware of the help that's out there for them. But looking forward, it's very, very uncertain times for renters. And how are they going to pay the rent when rent isn't coming down? Like, there was a tiny drop, maybe 0.5% or so in the last few months, but rent is still higher than last year. So it's very, very uncertain time for renters. We've put forward a number of proposals and practical proposals to assist renters, and then also some long-term ones to make renting better in the long term. Yeah,
we'll come on to talk about those in a little while. Just mm-hmm. I saw there, interestingly, in terms of homelessness, and obviously most people who are being made homeless are being made from the private rental sector, from evictions or not being able to cover rent increases. The figures of homelessness initially for the first 2 or 3 months of COVID dramatically dropped the number of presentations, particularly in Dublin. And we saw the impact of clearly the ban and obviously also the use of Airbnb properties that became free by the council and hotels. We saw dramatic inroads into homelessness and reducing it. There was inroads, maybe not dramatic, it's probably too strong a word, but definitely a dramatic fall in the presentations, but then an increase again in May. Do you kind of, have you seen that or kind of be any analysis of that?
No, there was no, it's come down again, I think, Rory.
Yeah,
no.
An increase in Dublin, sorry, apologies. There was an increase
in one region.
Yes, the region, but overall, nationally, yes, the fall, it was a continued fall.
Yeah, there certainly wasn't a consistent drop in each region every month, and it did up and down a little bit here and there. I must admit, actually, I haven't looked at the most recent one closely enough to see that that there was a bit of an increase in May, but that is worrying. And Dublin, not to be Dublin-centric about it, but the vast majority of people who are experiencing homelessness are experiencing it in Dublin. And I suppose if a trend occurs in Dublin, it tends to follow with the country as well. Yeah.
But so I suppose the overall point being made is that the moratorium and the ban had a major impact on reducing homelessness and not just protecting wider renters.
Oh, yeah, it had a huge impact. Like, I was looking at the overall general figures myself, and there was about a 20-odd% decrease in family homelessness and about a 20-odd% decrease in child homelessness. So between March and June, there were 702 less children in homelessness. Like, if that's not a good and positive thing and the common good, I don't know what isn't. I suppose it's something that people who work in our field have been saying for a long time. Even just put a ban on evictions just temporarily, just while we get a handle on this, just while maybe some of the other supports or services or houses come in behind it. And we can, so that we can keep people in their homes and get a handle on the, because what happens is with so many people in homelessness, it just becomes a job of managing that as opposed to actually putting in what's required to keep people in their homes and get people out into homes. And I do know, the council's very incredibly busy taking every opportunity to move people out of homelessness into housing. Like, for example, as I said, Airbnb properties to get their hands on. And so it really showed the effectiveness of it. It's not a silver bullet, but it certainly allowed us all to make a good inroad and dent in that homeless figure. And I suppose we're just anticipating now with the moratorium having dropped for the vast majority of people, that there would be a reversal on that.
Yeah.
Rory, just before you, the idea though, so it's 10th of August is when people can now officially be evicted. Evictions can restart is effectively the date, is the 10th of August. Can I ask though, this has been argued, which is funny, because now we've a Fianna Fáil Minister for Housing who argued before he went into government that this was, you know, that he would extend these things and he would agitate for these things and he would do these things. And now he has said that he can't because of advice from the Attorney General. You know, is this like, I don't know if Gavin, you might want to comment on this, but it does seem to me that these things need to be tested more.
Yeah, absolutely. The successive attorney generals and indeed successive governments have taken a very restrictive interpretation of property rights in the constitution, and you know, various legal academics and various people who've looked at it have come to the conclusion, I think, that, you know, the courts are often more willing to take a more liberal view of the common good and a more expansive view of the common good than the administration is. And it's really that block at the administration level which is stopping a lot of progressive housing legislation from advancing. So yeah, absolutely. You know, putting these things into legislation and allowing the Supreme Court, allowing the High Court to have a look at it is something that definitely should be done, I think.
And what, Gavin, maybe you could just set out, like, what has actually changed over the last, we saw the change in legislation last week. What's the actual change that's happened? What?
The bill that passed last week does two things, really. The first is kind of relates to temporary measures, which only last until January. And the second thing is a more substantive change to some of the procedures in the Residential Tenancies Act. So, in terms of the temporary stuff, what the bill does is it extends the moratorium on evictions and rent increases, but narrows it quite considerably. So it extends the protections only for what the bill calls relevant persons, who are people who have lost income or lost their job as a result of COVID. And it says that they're protected against evictions, but only if the evictions are taking place on the basis of you know, a notice of termination for rent arrears. And those people are protected up until the 10th of January. So it's extending that, that protection that was introduced in March, but it's narrowing it considerably. The second thing the bill does is it sets out a new normal, I suppose, in relation to, everybody else and how the process for a notice of termination for rent arrears is going to operate. So it says that the landlord must send a 28-day warning letter. He must copy the RTP in on that. The RTP will then liaise with the tenant and put them in touch with MABS, seems to be what the bill intends. And then There's a slight extension of the notice period for another 28 days when the actual notice is issued. So it very slightly enhances protections, but overcomplicates things, in my opinion, in introducing a new procedure for dealing with rent arrears or notices of termination for rent arrears. So those are kind of the two things. It's quite complex, obviously, but, you know, and very, very bureaucratic, but, that's basically what it does.
And in terms of just the specifics on it, what about if it's reduced the moratorium, the ban on evictions to this narrow group, is the evictions, can they be still evicted on the basis of sale?
Yeah, the other grounds in Section 34 of the Act, so things like sale or the landlord wants it for his own use or family use or change of use or whatever, all of those are now back on the table in as far as everybody in the country is concerned. It's just this smaller, narrow cohort of people who were directly affected by COVID in terms of their income that are protected until January the 10th from eviction on the basis of non-payment of rent, basically.
But they're not protected on the basis of sale. So landlord can turn...
Yeah, the landlord could still evict a relevant person for sale or any of the other grounds.
That's staggering. That's Amber, you made the point just before we went to Gavin that a lot of renters don't know this information properly. Like it's all wrapped up. It's all hidden.
Yeah, there will definitely need to be a public information campaign or something on this to make sure renters know. Even the minister himself said that the rent supplement needs to be advertised to people. So people didn't need to get into arrears. The rent supplement was there and the rules were relaxed. And those rules are still relaxed, I think, until the end of August. But people didn't know and didn't avail. Now, even at that, the calls that came to us about rent supplement were vastly increased. But people were ringing about arrears and didn't know about rent supplement and had to be told. If there isn't an accessible public information campaign on this and it, I suppose, simplified, because to be honest, even I'm struggling a little bit to get my head around it, and I've had Gavin explain it more than once to me. It's going to pass renters by. It's not going to have the effect it's supposed to have. Renters are supposed to, if they are relevant person, to notify the RTV, and there's a couple of criteria there for that. Now we're doubtful that the whatever number of renters out there are, you know, who are relevant persons, are going to declare themselves to the RTV as of this week. And even if the date, no disrespect to the RTV, but I don't know if they can actually, you know, take that on administratively. But for renters to know, what does that mean and what do I get from it? And I suppose, unfortunately, there can be a bit of despondency in renters. We would have seen it with the research that McBurn did with us recently, that, well, if the landlord wants me out, he'll get me out. You know, and so sometimes renters may decide to put their energy into finding a new home, a different home, rather than fight for the one they're currently in. And I suppose the very fact is, as Rory has pointed out, that they can still be evicted for other reasons. So it puts in a couple of legislative protections, but practically speaking, I think it will pass renters by. Yeah,
and the significance being the, and Tony, you know, you mentioned this earlier in terms of saying, you know, these changes, why they haven't, like, you mentioned the AG advice. On what basis, why did they not, in your view, Gavin, just extend this moratorium a further 5-6 months? It would have seemed the most obvious thing to do.
I suppose there was a slight legal issue when it came to extending the moratorium on the basis of the emergency legislation which passed in March, which was that I think the crux of the issue was whether or not there was a public health rationale for doing so. So I think, to kind of play devil's advocate and to maybe explain where the AG was coming from, I think the AG maybe felt that if you have schools open, if you have pubs open, it's very difficult to make a public health argument before the High Court that you need to still have a moratorium on evictions. Now, that obviously didn't prevent the government from passing new legislation to have a different basis on which to extend the moratorium. But the previous legislation, I think there was some argument there, and it was half valid that, you know, it would be difficult in December to say that there's a public health rationale due to COVID for evictions still being there if the rest of the country is entirely open. And that was kind of the roadmap. Now, that might change, obviously, but yeah, there's nothing to prevent the government from introducing a moratorium on evictions or tightening up the grounds for eviction or any of those things, quite separate from COVID.
But it appears, though, that, you know, again, go back to what Tony said and what we've raised significantly here, that in the podcast we've discussed about, like, this whole notion of the Constitution and the Constitution being a barrier, that, you know, it would have seemed obvious, okay, the public health rationale might not be there to justify it legally, but the government could have decided, if it wanted, well, actually, we want to do this in principle.
Yeah.
You know, and it seems to me that they obviously bended to the landlord lobby, or they bended that, you know.
Sorry, Rory, can I come in? There are constitutional lawyers and professors and associate professors who all argue that actually the AG's position is the minority position. You know, you don't have to scratch the surface. There's articles in the journals. We spoke to Owen Daly. I've spoke to these people. They will tell you, you know, and they said, and a lot of these places, they don't actually believe the constitution is the place for this. The government should just be legislating and getting on with it. So, you know, and pre-COVID, what was impossible all of a sudden became possible. And now we're all expected to believe that we never saw this happen. It's crazy.
But exactly. But that's the point. The question was, well, why then did they change it? Why didn't they just extend it and say, well, we have different rationale. We are going to just extend it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, that would have been entirely possible. And also, I mean, you know, the big picture is that, you know, the restrictions were brought in in response to COVID. And there was an implicit assumption there that banning evictions during COVID was serving the common good. But there's also an implicit assumption that banning evictions because of the housing crisis doesn't serve the common good. And, you know, they can't make that argument. So, but obviously, as you say, Rachel Walsh in Trinity is another academic who's argued very strongly that, you know, that the common good is absolutely served by introducing a ban on evictions and introducing progressive housing legislation because of the housing crisis, which is, you know, obvious, demonstrable, objective. It's there and let the courts decide. And her view, I think, is that, you know, the courts would be happy to have a look at that.
I want to come back then to the actual very real what this means, because we're talking in big specifics here. But over the weekend, you Threshold themselves had to open, you know, staff had to come in on the bank holiday weekend. They had to man the phones. Anne-Marie, what was there a spike in inquiries?
No. Luckily, well, I hope everyone knew about the service, so those that needed got in touch. No, luckily there was only a few inquiries, but still there was two people who had been evicted. But our just worry was that, you know, the legislation, the bill went through the Shannon on Friday, signed Friday night, and because it's quite complex and all the moratorium's been lifted, our real concern was that landlords and renters alike would think, oh, that's it now, I can be kicked out. And as I mentioned earlier, given the number of illegal evictions that we saw throughout the pandemic so far, there was a very real concern that renters would find themselves locked out or thrown out of their homes this weekend. So we felt there was a need to put that in place because of the moratoriums essentially coming to an end are for that very small number of people. So I guess from today onward, we will really kind of get a sense of what's going to happen for all those other people who aren't protected right now. Or we are hear from people who hopefully there weren't any others that were put out of their home over the weekend. But we felt there was a very real need to put that in place. Yeah. Because you know, passing something like that on a Friday before a bank holiday weekend,
it is though. This is where you bury your bad news, you know.
Yeah.
And it is highly likely we're going to see a return to, you know, the pre-COVID pre-measures like levels of evictions and, you know, that homelessness increasing again. And as you see yourself, like with so many tenants who just feel completely powerless, like we don't even hear about the evictions.
Yeah.
Like, two things I wanted to say. Are we measuring, do we have an idea of the level of rent arrears that has happened as a result of COVID? And also, are we monitoring the level of evictions?
So, when the ESRI went about doing their report on rent arrears, what they've, like, there is no record. There's no official record of that, you know, of rent arrears. So it was actually incredibly difficult for them to gauge how many people are in arrears and what the level of that is. So the only way you can do really gauge that is maybe through surveys, and that we're actually doing a survey ourselves at the moment. We'll have the results of it in a few weeks' time. But it's a small cohort, so you just have to use that as an indicator. And as regards evictions, again, it should kind of be ourselves and Threshold, you know, and other organisations. And we would just have our own records on it. Because I suppose if a landlord's going to carry out an illegal eviction, they're not notifying the RTV. So no, there's no, and I suppose that's one of the challenges with the private rent sector in trying to develop and devise policies and solutions for renters is because the data on it is so poor. We don't really know who the landlords are, and we don't know when the houses, an NOT is issued for sale, if the house is sold, who buys it? Does another landlord buy it? And the rents, we have the DAFT report, and that's the advertised rent. And then we have the RTB report, and that's the rent that's they're notified of when the tenancy is registered. Now, with annual registration, that might make that data a bit more up-to-date and reliable. But there's so many unknowns. And what strikes me is, even with with the huge drop in numbers and homelessness, there wasn't an extra bunch of houses built in the last few months. So those homes were always out there. And people either got to stay in them or got to leave homelessness and move into them. And so what that really shows is there's been just this churn of people through homelessness and the private rented sector for no good reason. But again, we don't have the information on that either, to identify when someone got put out of that house, where did they end up, where did they go next, and what happened to that home they were originally in. So at present, I guess, the data, you have to try and get it from a whole bunch of sources, cross-reference it, and try to come up with some bit of a picture of what's happening for people.
I think it's important to say as well, in relation to the bill, it doesn't really do anything to address the rent arrears that would have built up during COVID. So people who lost employment or lost sources of income during COVID, may be protected at the moment and may be protected until January. But in January, the same problem is going to present, which is there is this high level of indebtedness which people are carrying, and what is the government going to do about that, I suppose, is the question. The bill that was passed on last week just really kicks the can down the road on that. We still don't have a solution for those people.
So unfortunately, we could be right back here as homelessness starts to climb again. We've seen again as people have returned to work, there's been problems on construction sites, which will slow down supply, which will ultimately, we won't see these units that will be built that we were anticipating coming onto the market, and we will not see then the houses available for people to go into. It's a real vicious circle. I don't understand how, when we are facing a situation where I think I'm right in saying, is it 7 people died either homeless or in emergency accommodation in the last 10 days? Somewhere in that region, that this is not as much an emergency as it was a few months ago. And I know that's more of a statement than a question, but I just thought it was important to put that out there. Anne-Marie, can I ask, just from the perspective of the Gavin mentioned sending people to MABs. And as someone who's worked with people in mortgage arrears and working with MABs, are they tooled up, or are they the right way, or is that the right direction people should be going?
Oh, certainly. Like, I think MABs, from our perspective and what we propose to government, that they are part of that response to advise people on what their options are, perhaps negotiate with the landlord, have the repayment plan in place and things like that. But rent supplements there, you can apply for that. But it is one part, because it may not be the solution for everybody. So what we also wanted to see was the option of perhaps debt write-off where that's required, low interest finance where maybe someone needs to borrow the money to pay, if that's an option, if they know they will be returning to work and some, and also the landlord's position will come into it to an extent as well. Not every landlord's going to be able to take the hit on losing the rental income. So certainly MABs is one part of it. But there needed to be more, because people will need, some people are just going to need a dig out, like a very practical dig out, and getting those arrears cleared, making sure the relationship is still good with the landlord. and moving forward and moving on from it. And if they are not going to be returning to work for some time, to know that there will be the support of rent supplement or Happen Place, and it's highly likely their rent is probably already over the Happen rent supplement limits. And while there has been flexibility in that, we don't know how long that's going to go on. So it could be a case that it starts to come out with the landlord now, the rent supplement or HAP is up and running, it's paying the full rent, but in 4 months' time, it could be going, okay, your rent's going to drop now to whatever the rent, that the limits are on HAP rent supplement. And then it starts again. So, yeah, we wanted to see a number like of measures in place, and MABS being a part of it. So I suppose I can't really speak for MABS. I don't know to what degree they were consulted on.
I understand. I just think mm-hmm. There has to be more tools in the toolbox mm-hmm. to help yeah. people, as I suppose is what I feel as I look at it and I see yeah. what is, people, a lot of people who have lost their jobs in effect are because the economy was shut down. It wasn't mm-hmm. through any fault of their own. This is a unique circumstance and surely we need to, if we have this, the magic money tree, it turns out does exist. It's here at the moment and we should be availing of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think as well it's very significant when you contrast like the, and I come back to the figures and the data, like we know the level of mortgage arrears because the banks gather that data. We have no idea, as you're saying, of the level of rent arrears. So, you know, we've been through and studies have shown the devastating impact of mortgage arrears on families and individuals and the stress it caused and the kind of silencing. And renters are even worse. They don't even have the constitutional protection of their home. They have, you know, this relationship that they're trying to nurture and maintain with a landlord and do everything. They're completely, you know, disempowered. Mm-hmm. And I think for them, they're extremely, extremely vulnerable. And there needs to be, you know, much more done in terms of supporting them and how we go, you know, how we respond to it and even get a sense of it. What was your kind of sense of what should have been done in this context? Do you think the moratorium should have been extended, or what do you think needs to be done now from a legislative perspective?
Absolutely. We called for the moratorium to be extended till at least the end of the year, just to provide sort of breathing space to address those problems we spoke about earlier, you know, that indebtedness, maybe some sort of debt forgiveness, just to give us, the private rented sector a little bit of space to work that out. I suppose, you know, our call in terms of legislation would be for the grounds of eviction to be tightened. No fault evictions, I think, have to go. I think, evictions where the tenant isn't to blame for that eviction in some way have to end. So, you know, CL, family use, that sort of thing have to go. We've long called for the removal of Section 34B of the Act, which allows a landlord to evict for no reason every 6 years. That, you know, really doesn't have any place in a modern rental system. And, you know, we have a number of something has to be done about licensees. It's basically a wish list of things that we'd like to see done. But I think in terms of urgency, I'd very much like to see the grounds of eviction restricted, because it really is kind of, as Nick Burns' research pointed out, there's that tenant-led enforcement and it's just not working. It doesn't work. It never really has done. Landlords can evict for sale. They can evict for spurious reasons. There's really no follow-up.
And there's no way of regulating and policing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and like tenants' homes have to be recognised as their home. Rory, you mentioned the family home. A tenant's home needs to be protected in the same way. The fact that it can be whipped out from under them for all those various reasons, just, I suppose, it isn't right morally. And also, if the government and successive governments have made many big statements on trying to transform the private rent sector, so there's a slight U-turn going on in that now. It's like, oh no, we're going back to home ownership again. But there was this desire to make the rental sector a viable and larger tenure in Ireland. But but not recognising, well, those are homes that need just as much protection as the owner-occupied family home. And that still does not appear to be forthcoming. If the minister has promised legislation in September, we've no idea what's going to be in that. We're anticipating, hoping 34B at least will be removed. But I think we've gone beyond just needing 34B removed. It needs to be much, much more than that. And I suppose the moratorium on evictions the last few months have really proven what can be achieved. And I don't know if anyone really lost out from that moratorium on evictions. I certainly have. I know some of the landlord representative groups have said there's been some issues with antisocial behaviour and rent arrears, and that's fair enough. You know, no one's looking for evictions to be stopped where there is antisocial behaviour and issues like that. The RTB there is there to help sort out those issues. But who lost out from the moratorium on evictions? I don't know if anyone did, really. I think everyone won.
Well, I stand to be corrected on this, but I think it was Mel Reynolds gave the figure a couple of years ago about putting someone into the emergency accommodation costs the state about 30 grand a year.
Yeah. We reckon it's actually about 36,000.
Yeah, so yeah. You're looking at 36,000 a year. And Gavin, you mentioned some form of debt forgiveness here. I mean, that's an economic no-brainer, surely, yeah?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, the cost to the state, the economic cost to the state of evictions, quite apart from the moral and ethical concerns, is huge. So, even from a cold-eyed economic point of view, it makes sense to restrict evictions.
That's what I'm playing to the 2% of people who hate listen to us, you know, they just let them know that it actually makes sense to them financially as well.
Another thing, actually, I mean, just in relation to the bill, is that there seems to be this assumption at the heart of the bill that every notice of termination for non-payment of rent is valid. And that's certainly not something that we're seeing. So one of the concerns I would have is that there's this process which seems to kick in once a notice is issued and once the landlord informs the RTB, and the RTB put the tenant in touch with MABS, and it's not quite clear, but maybe they do some sort of back and forth with the landlord and with the tenant as well. But, and they, you know, they are obliged to inform the tenant. They can challenge the notice, but certainly, you know, a lot of notices for non-payment of rent aren't necessarily the tenant can't pay the rent. A lot of them are, there's a dispute about the amount of rent, or there's, you know, a car parking space has been taken away. So the tenant says, well, I'm not paying that, what the rent was, I'm reducing it. And a dispute emerges and that sort of thing. So, I don't know. I think we had a figure of 44%. I'm not sure if that's still current, but you know, a lot of the rent arrears notices we get aren't valid. And I'd just be concerned that the new bill is sort of pushing tenants into that process of, you know, MABS and the RTB negotiating with the landlord, where nobody like Threshold has actually looked at the notice to say if it is it valid or isn't it.
Well, there's a call to, you know, if anybody's listening and you've got concerns or you've got people who are maybe affected, you can go to threshold.ie. You can call the free phone number. Those details are there. We'll post them on the pod, because the information is critical.
And I think it's important as well. To me, it shows up again, this consistent issue as well, like the lack of supports that are there for tenants, and that, you know, Threshold is playing a really important, you know, role in supporting tenants. And obviously the more resources the Threshold can get, the better, then the more support. And also there's, you know, unions, like there's the new tenants union CAT who've been set up, which I think is very important as well. There's a real need for, you know, tenants to have that support and build their own support as well, to be able to challenge these and a real responsibility on government local authorities to highlight what is available for tenants and the protections available. Just to close, and we don't discuss a housing pod without bringing this up. The constitutional right to housing, it seems an obvious, again, situation to me anyway, that in the current context, the need to set it out really clearly that, you know, a tenant's house is a home as much as someone who owns it, and that the Constitution needs to have that balancing of the private property rights, where, you know, everybody has the right to, you know, an affordable, secure, mostly like secure home. What do you think about this, you know, in terms of responding? If we had a right to housing in place, would this be easier to respond to in terms of putting in place tenant supports and legislation around that? Gavin, what's your sense of that?
Absolutely, it would, yeah. I mean, Threshold is part of the Home for Good coalition, campaigning for right to housing in the Constitution. Ourselves and Simon, Focus, Mercy Law and others. So yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, the discussion that we had earlier about the ins and outs of whether or not legislating for the common good is appropriate or lawful in the context of a housing crisis, or whether it's lawful in the context of COVID and that sort of thing, that could all be done away with. We could just, you know, draw a line under that entire debate and insert a right to housing in the Constitution, which would allow the government to legislate for this crisis. I think Senator Rouhan said during the week on Twitter, you know, if the Constitution is preventing us from solving the housing crisis, then the Constitution has to change. And that sort of sums it up.
Yeah. No, we completely second that. And I suppose the question now is how, obviously, Home for Good is there as a campaign, and, you know, I'm part of it as well, and, you know, trying to promote it, that there is a need to kind of push now for that, because there's a lack of clarity in the programme for government around, you know, what referendum. It refers to a referendum on housing, but doesn't refer to the right to housing, and that there's a need for organisations to push now for that referendum in this context.
Yeah, and I suppose, in Home for Good, we launched there in January, and then the world was turned upside down between an election, a government trying to be formed, and a pandemic thrown in, now with the Programme for Government there, and a referendum on housing, which many of the people who are involved in, you know, negotiating the Programme for Government and who are now in government have referenced. So, yeah, a referendum on the right to housing, but as you say, Rory, in the programme itself, it's unclear. But those of us in Home for Good now will be becoming a bit more visible and reaching out to all, you know, our allies and the stakeholders in this sector, and bringing all of them together to seek and secure a referendum on the right to housing. And I suppose that's the first step. The next step will be winning it.
That's it. But
there definitely does seem to be a change in the public perception of late on housing and the home and what that means. And maybe it's because we have now had to be at home, and have some of us have felt the safety and security of that. And maybe perhaps others who did feel safe and secure in their home before now realise what it is to be on shifting ground. So, that'll be the campaign will be picking up a bit going forward.
I just finish what I was saying? I do think it's a great way of framing it now, because, you know, we understand that it's not homes for free. It's not homes dropping out of the sky, but it also then says coming out of COVID, a pandemic, and hopefully coming out of it, that we can say, well, we can do these things. We've seen what's possible. So why can't we progress and look forward on that way? I want to finish once and for all for myself on a positive, because I tend to be very negative on these things. Thanks for the work you guys do.
Thanks so much, Anne-Marie and Gavin. I think it is, you know, I suppose the change, the fact that the legislation wasn't put in place to extend the moratorium really shows that had we had that right to housing in place in the Constitution, that there could have been no argument against extending it, really, or at least a much stronger, you know, case there for it and backing for it. So that highlights it. Anne-Marie and Gavin, thanks so much for joining us today on Reboot Republic. We're delighted to have you with us, and best of luck with your fantastic work. And it's going to be really needed over the coming months, unfortunately. But we'll come back to you again in a short while and chat again and see where things are at, if that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Super. Thanks a million for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much for listening, folks. Remember, Reboot Republic is part of Tortoise Shack, and we rely on you guys at patreon.com/tortoiseshack. And much more importantly for this podcast, remember that the great people in Threshold who are doing homelessness prevention, you can support them by going to threshold.ie/donate. And if you or anybody else you know needs help or needs advice, their free phone number is 1-800-454-454. Thanks for listening. Talk to you all soon. Bye-bye.